New government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
It's regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulation.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much
business centers and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a special Friday edition of the Free Lunch podcast for the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. Please visit the RTP website at regproject.org. regproject.org to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. As always, I'm Devin Westhill, director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast is the culmination of Patent Week for the RTP and will examine the United States Patent and Trademark Office's new-ish administrative tribunal, the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, the PTAB. The PTAB was created to provide an efficient and inexpensive administrative process for eliminating low-quality patents, bad patents. However, the PTAB has earned a reputation among some as a prime example of regulatory overreach, so much so that a former federal appellate chief judge referred to the PTAB administrative judges as patent death squads. If its critics are right, the PTAB could be doing more than just harming the property rights that have helped to drive the U.S. innovation economy for over 200 years. So we want to explore it. Let's do so. I'm very pleased to have three guests as our Free Lunch Podcast featured speakers today. They're Josh Malone, Brian O'Shaughnessy, and Kristen Osanga. After today's call, if you're interested in learning more about any of our featured speakers, you can find more information at regproject.org. Now, this Free Lunch Podcast will go a little bit differently today. It's going to be panel style. I'll be moderating along with hosting. But I'll just be tossing up some questions to our panelists to explore. But before I get started, I want to remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and get started. The first thing I want to do, obviously, is I've mentioned that we've got three terrific guests on our Free Lunch Podcast today, Josh Malone, Brian O'Shaughnessy, and Kristen Osanga. What I want to do is allow them to introduce themselves to everyone on the call. I guess we'll go in that order alphabetically. First is Josh. Josh, can you introduce yourself to our speakers or to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Josh Malone. As you mentioned, I'm an independent inventor. Been my first career as an engineer at Texas Instruments. And about 11 years ago, left that to take on the independent inventing route, and I've been doing that since then. And had a recent success about 3 years ago with the Bunch of Balloons, water balloon toy. And so that's been my recent endeavor. So.
Thanks, Josh. I know we're going to hear a lot more about that invention later too. Brian, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Devin. I am Brian O'Shaughnessy. I am an intellectual property lawyer and a partner with the law firm of Dinsmore & Scholl in Washington, D.C. But perhaps more relevant to today's discussion, I am also the president and chair of the Licensing Executive Society USA in Canada. The Licensing Executive Society is a professional society, nonprofit, nonpartisan society that's dedicated to facilitating the transactions and transfers of intellectual property rights to more quickly and fairly bring products out of the lab and into the marketplace. So we represent what we think of as the entire innovation ecosystem, from research and development all the way through to commercialization. I look forward to participating in this conversation today, Devin, and like you, I'm going to offer a brief disclaimer. Any opinions that I offer today are not necessarily the opinions of my firm, Dinsmore & Scholl, nor are they necessarily the opinions of the Licensing Executive Society.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Brian. And finally, last but certainly not least, Kristen, would you like to introduce yourself as well?
Yeah, thank you. Hi, I am Kristen Ozinga. I am a professor of law at the University of Richmond School of Law in Richmond, Virginia. I teach mainly in the areas of intellectual property, including patent law. Before entering academia, I worked as a patent prosecutor and a patent litigator at a law firm in Washington, D.C., and I clerked for Judge Richard Lynn on the Federal Circuit. I am also a part of the IP working group that helped to draft the white paper on which this teleforum is based. So I look forward to sharing with you some of the things from the white paper.
Thanks a lot, Kristen, and thanks to all of our speakers for introducing yourselves. I want to launch right into the first question because I think that was a good segue by Kristen discussing the paper that was just released by the Regulatory Transparency Project that Kristen helped to draft and also that Brian was a contributor to as well. We published it earlier this week, Monday. It started off our patent week for the Regulatory Transparency Project, patent week. The title is Crippling the Innovation Economy, Regulatory Overreach at the Patent Office. That seems like quite a charge. I want to toss it out to you, Kristen. Can you give us some background on what this regulatory overreach is, in your opinion, and how it's crippling the innovation economy?
Sure. I'm happy to. So to understand the regulatory overreach, I'm going to need to step back to basics for just a minute. Hopefully won't bore some of you who know this stuff more intimately. So patents are property rights, and we grant them to inventors of new products or services in part to encourage this type of innovation. We, the public, certainly enjoy the innovation that patents have helped encourage. I mean, who doesn't like the latest and greatest cell phone, access to life-saving medicines, and driving fuel-efficient automobiles? But this is just a few obvious examples. To be honest, nearly everything we touch has one, and more often lots more than one, patents covering the technology that made that item possible. In order to receive a patent and thus obtain this property right in the invention, an inventor must submit an application to the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and the application describes the invention in detail and describes how to make and use the invention. That application then undergoes an examination at the Patent Office. Employees, who are known as examiners, patent examiners, scrutinize the application to ensure that the invention is truly new and that the application is adequately descriptive. Now, I am being very simplistic here, but understand this examination process is highly formalized and can take many years of back and forth between the inventor and the Patent Office before a patent is issued, and bottom line, is often quite expensive. So while patents are good, and the process by which patents are granted, this examination process that I described above, has been around for a very long time, there are, of course, some problems. Quote-unquote bad patents, by which I mean patents that shouldn't have been granted, maybe because they cover inventions that were not actually new, or maybe because they have some other flaw that interferes with the innovation rather than encouraging it, these bad patents can actually discourage real innovation by creating unnecessary costs for inventors and companies that otherwise would be bringing us really great technology. So it's this concern about bad patents that, in part, led Congress into 2011 to pass a new law known as the American Invents Act, or the AIA. One aspect of the AIA created the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, or PTAB, as it is lovingly known as, to provide a tribunal to invalidate these bad patents, and to do so more quickly and inexpensively than trying to invalidate patents in federal court system, which was the main avenue prior to the AIA. The TTAB is composed of administrative law judges, people who are knowledgeable about both technology and law, and these administrative law judges are appointed by the director of the PTO. The AIA, American Invents Act, created three different administrative hearings to review issued patents and invalidate bad ones. I don't want to spend a lot of my time on the details of the three various procedures, So I want to stick with a couple of common basics that are true for all of the procedures. The point of each of these procedures is this: to provide an avenue for anyone to challenge the validity of a patent that has been issued by the Patent Office during the patent's 20-year lifetime or term. In order to do that, a person, literally anyone, simply has to file a petition with the Patent Office alleging that one or more of the claims of a patent are invalid. A group of administrative law judges from the PTAB at the Patent Office decide whether or not to grant the petition. If the petition is granted, a formal proceeding reviewing the patent commences, where a panel of PTAB administrative law judges hears evidence and argument as to why the patent is invalid, and the patent owner is allowed to present contrary evidence and counterargument as to why the patent is valid. The PTAB panel then issues a written decision, and this is good and fast and cheap and easy, in theory, as the panel is required by the AIA to render the decision within 12 months, very quick. So, of course, having a procedure that is supposed to be cheaper, faster, and easier by which to invalidate bad patents is a good thing. After all, bad patents interfere with rather than encourage innovation. The intent of Congress was great in creating the PTAB and these post-grant review options, but unfortunately, the way the system has actually played out is anything but good. I know Brian and Josh have a lot more to say about the problems, but I do want to highlight just a couple of things to keep in mind as we continue this conversation. Anyone, and I mean anyone, can file a petition seeking to challenge the validity of a patent. This is very different from challenging validity in federal court, where there's a strict standing requirement. The person challenging it has to be hurt by the patentee. In the case of PTAB challenges, anyone can bring a petition. Another difference is that patents that are challenged in federal court are afforded a statutory presumption of validity. This means there has to be clear and convincing evidence of invalidity in order for a federal court to invalidate a patent. The PTAB, on the other hand, has a much lower burden of proof in its proceedings, a more likely than not type standard that makes it much easier for challengers to satisfy and have a patent invalidated. These two problems, along with many other issues that you'll hear about from Josh and Brian, are having a crippling effect on innovation. And I want to leave you with one specific statistic of this. The PTAB has invalidated between 64 and 98% of the patents it's reviewed. The reason that the range is so big is this depends on which of the three types of administrative proceedings the patent was challenged under. But this incredibly high level of invalidation means that the Patent Office is taking away the very same property rights that they gave. And that's a problem, and that's going to cripple the innovation economy. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Devin.
Thank you so much, Kristen, for that high-level view. I have a ton of questions after that, but I'm going to wait. We are going to have some time at the end of this call for Q&A, and so anyone who's listening should be thinking about any questions they might want to ask as we get through this panel discussion. Next, I want to turn to Brian, but I'm going to start by quoting Josh most recently last weekend when Josh said the PTO is issuing patents. I want to be very clear. It's, quote, issuing patents on one side of the office and the other side is changing their mind on those patents. Brian, how did we get here? Why is the patent office, quote, unquote, death squatting its own products, the very patents that it's determined to be worthy of protection?
Well, Devin, like so many things in the world today, it was born of good intention, but unfortunately the implementation has lagged. And I think as a result, we've wound up with a situation that's fraught with unintended consequences that are really, I think, harming the innovation economy as a whole. The idea could probably be traced back to the late 1990s when there was a particular case that came down called the State Street Bank case, which made it much easier to patent certain business methods and software and things of that nature that previously had been categorically denied patent protection. And with that, that sort of unleashed a whole host of area of patenting that, frankly, the patent office wasn't prepared to deal with. And so, consequently, there were arguably a great many patents that were granted simply because the patent office did not have the wherewithal and the resources to adequately examine those sorts of applications. And consequently, there was, I would say, a virtual flood of poor quality patents that issued. I think ultimately, in response to that, there were some people who were concerned about this flood of poor quality patents and realized that we might benefit from some more economical mechanism for challenging those patents and ridding the system of those patents. And so the notion was, well, federal court litigation is a very expensive undertaking and it's very time consuming, so wouldn't it be better if we had some other mechanism by which we could eliminate these poor quality patents from the system? And with that, there was a series of legislative proposals that worked their way through Congress and which ultimately resulted in the AIA, which Kristen, I think, did a fantastic job of putting in context along with the overall examination regime and the patent office's role of issuing quality patents for only those things that are useful, novel, and non-obvious. So the idea was, well, let's create this administrative proceeding that's less expensive than federal court litigation. And I think that's ultimately where the PTAB came from. At the same time that I think the economy was dealing with these poor quality patents, there were a number of bad actors, if you will, that were exploiting these patents and that were effectively holding people up and saying, well, you know, I've got this patent and you are infringing my patent. And, you know, with a wink and a nod, I'm going to recognize that the patent may not be all that great, but it's going to cost you perhaps a couple of $100,000 to get to a decision of a judge saying that the patent is no good. So rather than you spending that $200,000, why don't you just give me $100,000 and we'll both go our separate ways? This is the phenomenon of the non-practicing entity or the patent assertion entity. And it truly is, I think, an inappropriate practice. It's arguably an unethical practice, but nonetheless, it existed. And so I think that has led to a general sense that somehow we needed to attack that problem and we needed to rid the system of bad patents. And to my way of thinking, that's largely how we got to where we are today, at least with the creation of the PTAB.
Okay, that's really interesting, Brian. I don't want to let you off the hook just yet. I've got a follow-up here. Now, it sounds like the creation of the PTAB, as you've outlined it, and the post-grant challenges are a reasonable approach to solving those problems, right? It's cheap, efficient, you know, ostensibly a process for producing good patents. What happened, though? It clearly is born of good intentions, but it appears to me that, based on your statements, it's not necessarily bad patents that are challenged, but instead valuable patents. Let me give it back to you. What happened, Brian?
Well, there's a number of things. Once again, you know, the classic case of the devil being in the details. So when the PTAB was, I think, envisioned, it had perhaps a meritorious use. But there are a number of things, I think, that came into play that really made it an inappropriate approach, or at least in the way that it's implemented. First of all, the so-called NPE or patent troll problem has been widely overblown. The existence of patent trolls within the landscape are far fewer than what most people would like us to believe. So the incidents where people are bringing unethical challenges based upon a troll model is really far less prevalent than many would have us believe. In addition, I think the courts have effectively addressed those sorts of things. There are now heightened pleading requirements. Many judges have created expedited proceedings whereby at least some of the merits can be reached much more quickly. And I think courts have become a little bit more aggressive about certain discovery provisions and also the ability to impose sanctions on unethical enforcement of patents. And so the idea that there would be some form of sanction for an unethical bringing of a case, that would be something that the courts would sanction one of the parties for. So but the real problem, I think, lies in the fact that the PTAB uses a standard for invalidation that is much different than what you get in court. In court, you have the benefit of a presumption of validity of the patent. The court reasonably presumes that the patent office has executed its duties responsibly, ethically, and professionally, and capably. And so, therefore, we assume that all patents that the patent office has issued have been duly examined and have actually resulted in a legitimate patent that is entitled to that presumption of validity. In addition to that, there is a certain burden of proof that a challenger must meet in district court. The challenger must prove that the patent, that there's clear and convincing evidence that the patent is invalid. And unfortunately, the patent office has now instituted a proceeding within three proceedings under the PTAB, where the burden is much lower than it is in federal district court. So consequently, anytime a patentee enforcing meritorious claims of patent infringement, it's more likely than not that the defendant, the alleged infringer, is going to turn around and go back to the patent office and say, well, let's open up a PTAB proceeding here and let's assess whether or not this patent is really legitimately issued in the first place. And they know that by doing that before the patent office, their prospects for invalidation are far higher than they are before the district court, simply because the burden of proof is much lower. And so we are now in this very difficult situation and seemingly illogical situation where the federal district court could come to one conclusion about the validity of a patent, and the patent office could come to an entirely different conclusion about the validity of the patent. And ironically, because of the different standard and burden of proof, they could both be right. But if the patent office determines under its lower burden of proof that the patent is invalid or the claims of the patent are invalid, then that takes the patent out of the hands of the patentee, essentially renders it a nullity, and is in effect an administrative taking of a otherwise legitimate property right that the patent holder received from the patent office and likely depended upon to make significant and meritorious investment in an invention that the patent office told them was a good and valid invention. And I think that scenario is even further complicated by the fact that anybody can bring such a PTAB proceeding, and they can bring such a PTAB proceeding throughout the life of the patent. And so consequently, we have the prospect where a patentee might be subject to numerous and serial challenges before the patent office under this lower burden of proof, and that that prospect remains throughout the life of the patent. Well, what that means in effect is that the patentee, the patent owner, the entrepreneur, the inventor, is never entitled to quiet title in the patent. That now the patentee has to face the prospect that throughout the life of the patent, somebody can come along and challenge that patent and perhaps invalidate it and take away all of the investment and all of the prospects of future earnings that that patentee had depended upon. So needless to say, this is going to complicate the ability to attract investment, and it's going to complicate the ability to successfully execute on a business plan. And so it's for reasons such as this that the U.S. patent system has now been ranked number 10 in the world behind many other significant countries, but certainly a number of countries that are much less significant from an economic standpoint. So whereas the U.S. patent system had historically always been number one in the world for the quality of the patents that it issued and how it did it professionally and responsibly and the value that the patents derived as a result of being issued by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, now in a very short period of time, we've gone from number one to number 10, ranked, or I should say tied, with Hungary. So I think the whole system that we have now implemented has severely compromised the value of a U.S. patent, which in turn has compromised investment in growing companies, entrepreneurs, and startups, and what have you. And I think this is also reflected in the fact that recently it's been reported that for the first time since in the post-World War II era, the death rate of small startup companies now exceeds the birth rate. And one can only assume that the damage that we've done to our innovation economy by virtue of these sorts of proceedings has had an influence in that phenomenon. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, thanks again, Brian. And again, I have a ton of questions here. Number 10 in the world, our patent system, more deaths than births in terms of startups. This is paints not exactly a rosy picture, quite dire indeed. But we have one other panelist that we haven't heard from yet, and I think that was a good, solid foundation of the issues. Josh, I'd like to turn to you now. Now, I understand you have some personal experience with these issues, and I want to say oftentimes the IP world or the patent world is a little bit foreign to most people who aren't in it, because oftentimes we're talking about patents on biopharmaceutical, you know, whatever, and it's very difficult to follow. Now, your invention is one that I think is much easier for the non-technical layperson like me to follow, and I think it will be really interesting to hear your story, starting from your backstory and then going through what your invention is and what your experience at the patent office was. Could you give us first your backstory?
Sure. I guess it started in 2006. I left the corporate world, took the plunge at starting the business around an invention I had, and I pursued that and had some moderate success. Spent about 8 years pursuing that dream of inventing, and in combination with a lot of consulting to pay the bills along the way. And it was a great run, but it was coming to an end. I had college still unfunded, a lot of orthodontics that had been put off. And so this was late 2013. I was updating my resume, looking at job openings, just dreading going back to that environment. But I had one last seed of an idea I wanted to pursue. And so it's the middle of winter now. It's January 2014, and I pull out this idea I'd been struggling with for over the course of several summers, and that was how to fill and seal a water balloon, of all things. So I had a lot of personal experience with that with my children, and in the summers in Texas, we put them outside, and you got to play with water. And so it was also an excuse for me and other dads, to be children again. And so I was dedicated. I would bring home the 500 pack of water balloons, and the kids were having a water balloon war. We'd go out in the back and start filling them. And an hour later, the kids are like, "Come on, Dad, can we start? You know, I'm like, "No, we haven't filled all the balloons yet." And so I'm just persevering, and at the same time thinking about there's got to be a better way to do this. And I've discovered since that the water balloon was invented in 1950, and for 63 years, that's how people did it, just like I was doing it. They filled them one at a time, and they tied them with a knot. And so I finally had this concept I brought out, and as my last ditch effort to pursue the invention dream. And my idea was to put an elastic ring around the neck of the balloon and to allow that to seal it. And I was able to get a ring installed around a balloon. And of course, there was nothing in it at this point. It was an empty balloon. So I had to figure out how to open up that ring and get the water in. So I procured a tube and, shoved it through the neck of the balloon to spread open the elastic ring. And then, so I had a passageway for the water. And then I looked at the other end of the tube and I thought, I got to get the water in there. So I decided to take a cap that goes on the end of a garden hose and put a hole in it and then stick the tube in it. And that looked like it would work, but I looked at it and the tube looks really lonely because it's this teeny tube and this big cap of the garden hose. I immediately thought, hey, I should give it some friends. And so I proceeded to fill the end of that cap with holes and in each one attach a tube with a balloon and a elastic ring at the other end. And so I had 37 tubes and balloons attached and glued into this cap. And I took it out back and hooked it up to the hose, turned it on, and the balloons, they filled up. And I gave it a shake, they fell off, and they sealed themselves. And it was just magical. I mean, that maybe some of the audience has seen the videos at this stage or tried it themselves. But that was the moment in January 2014 where I thought, this might solve the problem for more than just me and my family. And so that was the genesis of Munch of Balloons.
Now, I can see that in my head. I haven't actually tried that yet. I have an 8-month-old at home, and I suspect I will at some point. But I want to know what happened then. I mean, look, you're successful, right? You've got this device that you've created after water balloons have been around since 1950. You finally figure out how to fill 100 at a time and shake them off and seal themselves and get right to enjoying backyard fun with your family. Patent this thing and live the rest of your days off of this, right?
Well, I was optimistic, but cautiously so. There was a long road ahead, and so of course I filed for a patent pretty much immediately, and then proceeded to a crowdfunding campaign through the Kickstarter platform. Put my invention out there for the public to get behind and vote on and all that. And it just blew up and went viral. And within a few hours, we exceeded the goal and eventually raised almost $1 million from 22,000 backers. And in the process, had lots of inquiries, retailers wanted to know, can I ship 1 million of them? And I'm like, I'll get back to you as soon as I'm ready for that. And then the media got a hold of it and ended up getting a call from the Today Show, and I flew out to New York and had a water balloon fight in Times Square with Carson Daly. And so it was a whirlwind. And so we knew we had a winner when the Kickstarter campaign took off. Signed a licensing deal with a toy company called Zuru, who's just been a fantastic partner since then for the past 3 years. And then it was, everything was going great. And just a few months later, a friend of my wife's mentioned, "Hey, I saw your husband's invention on TV, but it was under another name." And I wasn't surprised there were knockoffs, but I didn't think it was possible it could be that fast and that blatant. So I assured her it couldn't be in my invention. But I went and did the research, and sure enough, there was my invention with someone else's name on it, on, you know, running advertisements on TV. And so there was an infringer. My patent was pending, and so we had competition. But I knew the patent would, you know, I expected the patent would solve that problem when it came through, which it did. So in early summer 2015, the patent issued, and so I was able to bring an infringement case against the infringer. And it's been, it was effective. So we were able to obtain a preliminary injunction, and they had to stop selling the knockoff. Interestingly, this particular infringer is kind of notorious for this type of behavior. But so they immediately, after the injunction issued, they created an alternative version, which they claimed did not infringe the patents. And so 2016, we brought another infringement suit, obtained another preliminary injunction. And believe it or not, it happened again this year. There's another version out. We brought another case, obtained the third preliminary injunction. And these injunctions, the standard's incredibly high. We had to prove that we were likely going to prevail at trial on the infringement. We had to prove that there was no substantial question of validity of the patent, that there was irreparable harm. These are incredibly difficult standards to meet, but we met them. And so the system's working. It's slow and it's expensive, but it was working. And of course, the subject of this call, you can guess what the infringer did. They went to the patent office arguing that the patents were mistakenly issued. And so far, the PTAB has agreed with them. The first patent's been canceled. As a result, the trial has been stayed indefinitely. We were supposed to go to trial last April. And then the second and the third patent, the PTAB has determined that it's likely, more likely than not, they're invalid because they're obvious. And so they've decided that what I did was not really an invention. It's obvious. So those patents are under review right now. There's a fourth and a fifth and a sixth patent that have been challenged as well by the same infringer. So we've now litigated this extensively in the courts. We prevailed throughout. We've expended over $17 million now on enforcing the patents, and thanks to the PTAB, it's still in limbo as to whether the government or the patent office believes I have an invention or not. So that's where I stand.
Well, the first half of that was really encouraging and really exciting. The second half, not so much, obviously, Josh. I mean, that goes without saying. But this was obvious since 1950. No one just decided to try to do this, or patent it, or create 100 balloons at once. It's pretty surprising. I have one follow-up question for you, and then I think we'll have a couple of other questions maybe for Kristen and Brian. But, I mean, what has this experience done for your desire or your passion to invent or innovate? You mentioned that first time you shook the water hose and you saw all of those balloons fall and tie themselves off, or to seal themselves, I should say. It was just sort of a eureka moment. It was this incredible, incredible moment. I mean, how do you feel now about your desire or passion to invent? You're saying that, you know, this has cost you $17 million, and I imagine, you know, a huge headache.
Well, I think I'm representative of, you know, hundreds of thousands of creative, inventive-minded individuals, and that desire is still there. But going forward, I can't justify the investment. I mean, I need to take the corporate job because I can't be spending, you know, my life savings and my investors' money pursuing an invention that I ultimately cannot expect to have the exclusive rights to. So there's a desire, but there's a practical limitation as to you know, how much I can pursue that desire.
Yeah, certainly understand that. And so, I mean, we have a sense now from the horse's mouth, what it feels like to go up against the U.S. Patent Office's PTAB. Brian, I want to turn back to you if I can. What does this mean more broadly for our economy? And you touched on this briefly in your remarks, but our standing as a technology center and home to some of history's greatest inventors.
Well, we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot, aren't we? I'll turn the question back at you, Devin, and assume for a moment that you're a wealthy investor and you've got a pile of cash and you want to invest it in a promising enterprise. You know that in the U.S., for example, that promising enterprise is dependent upon its intellectual property. In the U.S., they might get those rights after they've proven that there's an invention and that there's something worth protecting there, but they don't know whether or not it's going to be enforced, whether or not they're going to get an injunction, and whether or not they're going to be able to actually maintain the patent throughout the life of the patent. It's going to be forever subject to serial challenges by anybody who's so inclined. Are you going to invest in that enterprise and put your money into the U.S. economy, or are you going to put it in the economy in perhaps Germany, set up your company in Germany, where you're much more likely to get an injunction, and after a very finite period of time, you're going to be entitled to the quiet enjoyment of your title, of your patent. Or perhaps you're going to go to China, which not long ago barely recognized invention and barely recognized patents. And now China is making a big deal out of the fact that not only are they going to enforce patents owned by foreign nationals, but they're going to penalize infringers with injunctions and punitive damages. So now all of a sudden China is looking like they're being very aggressive and respectful of intellectual property rights, at least superficially. So where's that money going to go? It's probably not going to go to the U.S. It's going to go to some country where intellectual property is more reliable, durable, and predictable. And so, you know, we're really undercutting our own global competitiveness by failing to respect the fundamental property right that exists in a patent, the fundamental property right that the founding fathers specifically provided for and recognized as a personal property right. And now we have drastically diminished the value of that property right and made it much more difficult for people like Josh to fund a company and support their family and to create jobs. So I guess that's really the bottom line, is that in a time of intense global competition, we should be strengthening our intellectual property system rather than tearing it down and weakening it.
Thanks again, Brian, for that. And we've got about 18 more minutes on our hour-long call here. So at this stage, we've heard from each one of our panelists. I'd like to hear from the audience to see whether or not there are any questions. So in a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, if you'd like to request the floor to ask a question of any of our panelists, all you need to do is enter the star and then the pound button on your telephone keypad. Okay, the floor mode is on. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt and then you can ask your question. We'll answer any questions that we receive in the order in which they're received. Now, we have a couple questions queued up, but I have one follow-up question, which I think is just, we haven't heard it yet, but it just seems terribly logical to ask it at this stage. And I welcome any panelists who'd like to weigh in on this, but the question is, what's to be done? Can the PTAB be repaired, or must we dismantle it altogether? Anyone have any thoughts?
I'll take a stab at it, Devin. This is Kristen. It may be that the problem is solved for us. Something interesting happened fairly recently. The Supreme Court granted cert in the oil states case, and the issue the Supreme Court is actually going to be looking at is whether or not it's constitutional to have an Article I tribunal, an administrative agency, extinguish these property rights of the patent. So it could be that that this is determined to be unconstitutional and you know, problem potentially solved, and all is well and good. But I think, you know, in the absence of that, if the PTAB stands, and the white paper provides some of this information too, if the PTAB does stand, there's ways we could do this to make it better. Just playing off some of the issues that I brought up, you know, maybe having a more rigorous look at standing. Make sure that the people who are bringing these challenges have a real reason to be doing so rather than just to be harassing of patent owners. Or have a higher burden of proof required in order for a patent to be proven invalid, more similar to what's used in the federal courts. If it was also used in the PTAB, perhaps we wouldn't have so many patents being invalidated. So those are just a couple of ideas that might help solve some of these problems.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I mean, I think the oil states case has the opportunity to really address this issue, and most importantly, to address the patent as a personal property right, and I certainly hope that they do that. But I think some of the potential fixes also reside within the patent office itself. As Kristen mentioned, you know, the burden of proof that the PTAB employs is not imposed by statute. That's something the patent office itself can change. There are a few other things that are out there where we know people are manipulating and exploiting the PTAB system to what I would call illicit gains, whether they're shorting stocks in association with a PTAB challenge, or they're simply extorting license rights on the prospect that they're going to bring a PTAB challenge. There's lots of abuse that's going on out there. And there's something called the integrity loophole. The patent office has no mechanism to sanction the illicit use of the PTAB proceeding. So even if somebody is doing it completely fraudulently without any legitimate basis and for other ill-gotten gains, there's nothing that the PTAB can do, and there's nothing the patent office can do. And so the patent owner, whether it's Josh or it's anybody else, if somebody is abusing the PTAB system, they have no recourse. And so I think that, you know, the burden of proof, the ability to bring the action for an indefinite period of time, the integrity loophole, these are just some of the things that I think are within the patent office's control and can be addressed. Some will require legislation, but we would like to see the patent office sort of coming together about addressing some of these issues, and to date, we haven't seen that.
Well, thank you. And no pressure, Josh, but did you have any thoughts on this?
Sure. you know, the problem, fundamental problem with the PTAB is it's completely at odds with the charter of the patent office, and their entire mission is to cancel patent rights, and it's just susceptible to political interests, and there's a cross purposes, and I don't see how the patent system can do what it's intended to do as long as the PTAB exists. In fact, it's distracted the office from their job, which they have complete control over the issuance of the patent, and they're not taking that seriously. So when the director signs that patent, historically, that's the end of it for the agency. It's gone. It's left the agency, and if there's any dispute about it, it needs to go to the courts. And so, as long as the patent office thinks they can have a mulligan and get it right later, then the PTAB is going to continue to grow. It's going to continue to devour the work product of the examining division. So I don't see how it's compatible with a stable patent system.
Well, I certainly understand what you're suggesting there, and thanks for those comments to all of you. Again, to ask a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We're going to go to our first question now. Once you hear the prompt, you can ask your question, caller.
Yes, my name is Paul Hayes. I'm calling in for a question for the panelists. I understand that Michelle Kwok Lee was appointed by President Obama, and she implemented the PTAB using the American Vents Act. I'm wondering, you know, to me this seems like, since Michelle was the former head of IP at Google, having the fox guarding the chickens, I'm wondering if the panelists could comment on how the actual PTAB differs from what Congress may have had in mind with the AIA, American Vents Act. Thanks.
Thank you. Sounds like a question either for Kristen or Brian. Any thoughts?
Well, I'll take a quick stab at it, and then I'll let Kristen take a shot if she wants. Certainly, the PTAB, as it was envisioned in the AIA, had certain parameters that are legislatively determined. And I think it's safe to say that Director Lee abided by those statutory requirements. But as I said, there are certainly a number of things that were left to the discretion of the director. And to my way of thinking, some of those things were implemented in a way that tilted against the patentee as opposed to in favor of the patentee against infringers. And so I think that the pendulum has sort of swung in favor of a skepticism toward patents, whereas historically and largely throughout America's history, we have had profound respect for inventions, inventors, and patents. And we have seen this as a means to get technology out of the shadows of trade secret protection and into the bright light of disclosure that's found with a patent. And we need to swing that pendulum back to a point where the patent, in fact, is an asset that an inventor can rely upon to ply his or her trade and to continue to invent to the betterment of society. And if we don't do that, as I say, investment and inventors will go elsewhere where there is a more hospitable regime. And it's just too easy to do that today. And so consequently, we are undermining our own competitiveness unless and until we reverse this trend and institute a certain respect for U.S. patents.
Thank you, Brian. Any thoughts, Kristen?
Just a quick follow-up. I largely agree with Brian. One thought I have, though, is a reason that I have hope, is that the respect for United States patents has been a little cyclical. In fact, one of the things that led to the creation of the Federal Circuit, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in the early 1980s, was the idea that the courts weren't respecting or understanding the importance of U.S. patents. And so then by instituting the Federal Circuit, we had a strong run of patents are good and the world was a good and happy place. And so I think there's hope that we can the pendulum can swing, as Brian said, and go back in the right direction. So have hope. But the other thing I want to say in response to Paul's question is the way the system's set up is a little like the fox guarding the hen house, to use his terminology. But it's even a little worse than that, because we are leaving in charge to determine if a mistake was made the very institution that made the mistake to start with, if a mistake was ever made. It's kind of a weird layer of bureaucracy to say, hey, monitor yourself because we don't think you might have done a good job the first time. And when you give somebody that directive, for them to feel that they're doing it right is almost to find that they did a bad job, because otherwise why would you have needed to institute this layer of bureaucracy? And so I think that the setup itself is designed in order to be very anti-patent, and I think that's a concern. So I'll turn it back to you, Devin.
Okay. Thank you both. Now, that's an important point. I'm glad that you contributed that, Kristen. I want to say again to the audience here that if you'd like to ask a question, all you need to do is enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. I want to, it's a great I mean, I think what we're talking about here is reform. What exactly should we do if critics of the PTAB are right? If the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project IP Working Group's paper is right, that that the regulatory overreach at the Patent Office, the PTAB, is really crippling the innovation economy. I have a question I'd like to just throw out to the panel again, and anyone can respond. I've heard some high-level sort of reform suggested, even Josh, I think, suggesting that the PTAB should just be closed down completely. Now, the question I have is there something the PTO can do itself to remedy the situation, or does it require an act of Congress? Just recently, Senators Coons and Cotton introduced the Stronger Patents Act of 2017, or is there something the Supreme Court needs to do? I mean, what can the PTO do something? The question is, I guess, can the PTO do something to remedy some of the concerns that we've that the panelists have expressed on this call itself? Anyone?
Well, this is Brian. I guess, as I said, there are certainly some things that the PTAB can do that have been left to their discretion. But by and large, I agree with both Josh and Kristen. The function of the PTAB is really at odds with the fundamental notion of what the Patent Office ought to be doing. We should be holding them accountable to their decisions. And so there is this sort of disconnect, this logical disconnect that exists, and I think we need to address that at the root. And chances are that's going to require some legislation. So the Coons and Cotton Stronger Patents Act is certainly a good approach. I'm not saying that it's perfect in its current form, but I certainly agree that they have a very informed approach, and that I think the idea that getting some legislation to address some of these issues is probably going to be very helpful. I think there's reason for optimism that that the system can be fixed, and that there are folks in Congress who are waking up to the need for fixing it. And hopefully they'll get some traction and we'll get some movement. But what we can't do is continue down this path of weakening the patent right and depriving legitimate patent owners of the rights to enforce their IP, whether it's at the PTAB or whether it's in the federal courts.
I feel like that's going to be a position that's shared by our panelists, Brian. And we have just 4 minutes left. I wanted to give anyone on the panel an opportunity to give some closing remarks, some final thoughts about what we've discussed here, things more broadly about the PTAB, perhaps something else that we haven't brought up yet about the paper that was released on Monday that can be found at the regproject.com website. Anyone would like to give final thoughts, final remarks?
I'd like to, Devin. So just about the white paper and also just, a little information. The story that Josh shared with us today is really compelling and really interesting, and I wish that it was the only story like it. I wish Josh was an anomaly. I apologize, Josh. I don't wish you were an anomaly, but you know what I mean. So I pulled up quickly from the Patent Office website, some information, and 7,300 petitions have been filed since the AIA procedures were opened. That's 7,300 in 5 years. And of that, they instituted 3,700 plus proceedings. So these are not things that are just getting dismissed early. A lot of them are actually going to the full proceeding. And then once it reaches that full proceeding, that's where we hit that number of 64% to 98% being invalidated. And from the Patent Office's own website, the statistics are that in 17% of the cases where the post-grant proceeding is instituted, 17%, some of the claims are invalidated, and in 65%, all of the claims are invalidated. And so there's 82% right there of taking away of patent property rights from people, and it's not a small deal. This is not a so sad it happened to Josh. This is happening to a lot of companies. The white paper gives some examples of other companies that this is happening to, so I encourage reading that to get some more stories like Josh's, because this is a prevalent and an important problem.
Can I spring off of that, Kristen? You're correct. So as a result of the abuse I've suffered, I've done some research and I've gone through, I mean, I listen to these cases, I look at these cases, and the vast majority of them, there's a real invention that was supposed to be secured by patent right. And you can see, you know, what we've discussed in theory at the PTAB, you can see it happening when you look into these cases where they're doing everything they can to try to avoid finding the invention. So they'll construe the claims of the patent in a way that reads out the invention and reads in the prior art, effectively saying, oh, you didn't really, you know, you're trying to claim an invention that was obvious or something that's already been invented. But the patent office knew the first time around these guys invented something new. And so I've looked at cases like Zond that's had 125 trials, the PTAB, and others that have invented new products or improvements on technology and have started businesses and gone to market. And nearly every one of these cases, those 3,700 that you mentioned, I won't say nearly everyone, but the vast majority, there's a real story of abuse like mine behind it. And it's just being waved off by, you know, the powers that be saying, well, I guess their patent wasn't valid. And so these decisions, when you dig into them, there's really a big problem going on in the majority of these cases.
Yeah, and I'll just add a final thought as well, Devin, if I may. I think that throughout the conversation, we've highlighted a couple of things. There's a rather profound violation of due process for inventors under the PTAB as it exists today. And you couple that with the fact that we ought to be looking at this as a personal property right, and the fact that an administrative agency, the very agency that issued the patent in the first place that should be presumed to have done its job competently, is now taking that personal property right away without the protections of an Article III court, is a travesty of justice. And I think most inventors, aspiring inventors, investors, and anybody who cares about the innovation economy ought to be upset, concerned, and outraged about the way that this is being conducted. And they should contact their representatives in Congress and their senators and let them know that they're upset and they're concerned, and that we need to get back to respecting intellectual property rights as a personal property right.
Outstanding final words, Brian. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, Josh, for your final remarks as well. I want to say to our audience, on behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thank you for joining us. And, of course, another big thank you to Brian, Chris, and Josh for participating in this free lunch podcast call to top off Patent Week. I want to remind everyone who's on the call that there was a paper that was released on the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project website at regproject.org titled Crippling the Innovation Economy, Regulatory Overreach at the Patent Office, which contains lots of information on the issues that you heard here, among other things. Hopefully someone on the call will share that with anyone writing briefs in oil states. But in any event, I look forward to your joining us again for our next installment of Free Lunch. Until next time, so long, everyone.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.